Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 25 years of service, Ron Capps saw plenty of action. As a soldier, an army officer, and then a foreign service officer documenting war crimes, he's worked in some of the world's deadliest places. From the grave horrors of genocide to almost daily deprivations in Kosovo, Central Africa, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Darfur, he experienced 5 wars in 10 years. Ron was haunted by his inability to stop the killing of civilians and plunged into depression. His marriage, career, and mental health unraveled, and Capps found himself with a loaded pistol in the back of a pickup truck in a Sudanese desert, ready to end it all. Here's his account of that moment from his new memoir, Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years.
The clarity passed, and I was overwhelmed with a sense of futility and sadness. I had failed to stop the wars. So many people were dead because of my failures. The images were rushing at me, the 45 dead from Rachak, the raped nun from Bunia, the man with the red-rimmed eyes and his mutilated family near Sinek. I picked up the pistol and charged it, loading a bullet into the firing chamber. My hands were shaking. I put the beer down. I took the pistol off safe. I was sobbing and talking to myself, to the spheres, to no one. The pistol was ready. I shifted it to my left hand. I looked at it in my hand, lying partly on my lap and down a bit. I took a deep breath to calm myself. I was ready. Then the phone rang.
That phone call saved his life. He got help and has helped countless others as founder of the Veterans Writing Project. Ron Capps, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, that phone call did save you. It was your then-wife, Maureen, and you were medevaced out at your own request, eventually back to D.C. with an office job. Talk about living in D.C. There was a point when you overreached, thinking that you could go see the Washington Nationals play. What was going on with you then?
Well, like you said, I was just back from my 5th war and a suicide attempt. I was newly divorced. My mom had just died. I was completely overwhelmed with everything going on in my life, and I wasn't taking care of myself. All of this PTSD in my life, all of that had to do with the fact that I didn't take care of myself. I just kept deploying and deploying and deploying without sufficient time at home to decompress, to reprogram. And when I got to Washington, I was surprised that even having been medically evacuated, even having been sent home, no one really seemed to want to follow up with medical care. No one stopped me and said, hey, you have to go get this medical treatment. I was just assigned to this office full of introverts and sat quietly doing my reading and my writing and my briefings of senior officials. And I was trying to get better on my own. Mm-hmm. I eventually sought medical care. But in that interim period, you know, the incident you talk about, I lived on Capitol Hill, not too far from where the Nationals played. So I walked down there one day to see a game. And this was at the old RFK Stadium that was one of those 70s venues where they would try and do any possible type of event from concerts to football games to baseball games. And it just had this huge area up at the very top. Well, I'd bought tickets to sit down near the field, but as I was walking down the aisle, I just realized that it was all too much. There was just far, far too much going on, and I couldn't focus, and the anxiety just began to rise in me. So rather than just running away, I decided I would try and stay in the game, but I found a nice quiet place way up on the third deck where the other misanthropes were. And we all sat quietly by ourselves, together, alone, way up on top.
Well, that's a question. I mean, we hear a lot about the military shunning or looking down upon admissions of mental illness, you know, perceived as weakness or whatever. What did asking for help mean for you, an intelligence officer and an Army officer?
Well, at that point, what I thought asking for help would mean was that I feared I would lose my security clearance, which meant I would have lost my job because I could not work without a security clearance. But I also feared I was in a unit that was an airborne unit, so I'm surrounded by paratroopers, surrounded by Rangers, and I thought that my peers would look upon me as being weak, as being broken, that I couldn't hold up, that I couldn't take the stress, that I couldn't take all the things that I was doing, when in fact it was all the things that I had done that was catching up with me.
You just said the things that you had done, but it's sometimes the things that you hadn't done that is really kind of haunting you. And I'm talking about these because I read in your book that it is important to talk about them communally. If you wish to or you're able to, do you want to share an experience that overcame you until you overcame it?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's sort of what this book is all about, is getting control of those memories and showing others that it is possible to do so. I mean, one of the events that will always haunt me was in a little town called Senek, and it was in either late August or early September of 1998 during the insurgency in Kosovo. And we went into this village called Senek because the Serbs had come through the day before and there were civilians killed. And so my team drove up to this village and we went to watch as some civilian Kosovars were burying the dead from the Serbian attack the day before. So we had to verify that these people were dead, what had happened, and that's relatively standard work. But as we were leaving, a crowd surrounded our vehicle, and I got out of the truck to talk to them, to hear what they had to say, and my translator was standing beside me, and this woman pushes her way through the crowd and holds her infant child out at arm's length, pointing the child at me. And my translator says, she wants you to take her baby away so the Serbs won't kill him. And I knew I couldn't do this because to relocate civilians, we could have lost our status in country and we would then have been no help to anyone. And so I felt like I was hiding behind this bureaucracy, and that will always haunt me. And that action not taken is one of the things that gets at what Jonathan Shea and Brett Litz do at the Boston VA hospital in their research on what are called moral injuries. Mm-hmm. And it's some action that a person takes or fails to take or even witnesses that transgresses closely held personal beliefs and moral beliefs. And I knew, of course, that the right thing to do would be say, okay, I'm going to take your child with us and give this child protection, to take that child in my arms. But diplomatically, politically, professionally, I knew that to do so would mean I would be put out of the country and perhaps my entire team. But I also have to add here that one of the other internationals, I think someone from the UN High Commission for Refugees, did come back that evening, and as is part of their charter, their authorization in country, they were allowed to do this sort of thing. And so they did relocate some of the children to a safer village.
We're talking with Ron Capps. He was a career Army and Foreign Service when PTSD knocked him off track. He got to the other side by writing, among other things, and is founder of the Veterans Writing Workshop. His new book is called Seriously All Right. Well, Ron Capps, you had fallen apart in the past over drinks with another officer in Senek, remembering this experience with this child and the slaughtered families and a Serb officer with a gun to his head in another incident. And you write, this is the last time I let myself publicly go. So is this book letting yourself go publicly?
Well, I think it is in many ways. The night that you referenced, one of my colleagues came in to the room where I was staying and was doing this writing at night, and I just fell apart. I was crying, and I'm sure it was a terribly embarrassing moment for my colleague. But I never let go of my emotions in front of another colleague. Now that I'm retired, this story, the important part of this story is the story of hope, that there's a road home, that people can find this road. And if writing is what works for people, that's fabulous. If it's art, dance, music, drama, traditional therapies, acupuncture, whatever it is, if there's a road home, go find it. And that's the hopeful part of the story. But that hopeful part doesn't really make sense without telling the how I got out to that point in the desert. So I am letting go of it. It is sort of a type of therapy for me to just allow these stories to be told. But what I really want people to understand is that there is a road home, and you can see what happened to me. Much worse things have happened to others, but this is my story, and here's how I came home. Maybe you can find your own way.
And for you, in coping with your PTSD, took a what you call a journey through Prozacistan, tried drinking too much, tried talk therapy, a number of typical ways to do it, dug deeper into the nature of this returning soldier, leading you to your own writing. Now, how is that connected for you?
Well, when I came back from my service overseas, I was clearly not all right, and I needed help. So I sought medical care with a psychiatrist. I was given medications. We tried different rounds, different combinations, different cocktails of medications. I was doing talk therapy. We were trying all sorts of things, and maybe my expectations were too high, but I didn't feel as if I was getting well enough, fast enough. And whether we changed the drug or we went to a different type of therapy, nothing really seemed to me to be working. Until I realized that the writing I had done in country, in theater, and the writing I continued to do at home seemed to be helping me. So just let me give a little bit of background here. My job as an intelligence officer, or my job as a State Department political officer, was to go to some foreign country, get on the ground, learn as much as I could about the culture, the society, the people, their grievances, their desires, their needs. What's the history of this rebellion? How did it form? How can we try to solve it? And then write about that to a readership back in Washington, whether at the State Department or the Pentagon. And so I would go out into these areas and come back and write these relatively crisp, dry reports about what quite often were messy, horrible acts of cruelty. And even when I was in theater, I knew that this wasn't enough. I knew I had to capture more of this. So when I finished my work for the day, I would go back to my tent or to my room, wherever it was, and I would sit down and I would continue to write. And I would write the whole story. I would write about the look on that woman's face rather than the fact that there had been 8 killed in that village. Mm-hmm. There had been 11 wounded, with one being a 72-year-old man. Just the facts in those government reports. I wrote more about it. I wrote more about what it felt like, about what their looks said to me. And so I did this for 10 years. When I came home, I still had all of this writing, and I started going through all of that writing and editing it and just rewriting everything until those memories were no longer able to take control of me. I put up a little sign in the attic that I use as my office, and it says, either you control the memory or the memory controls you. And that's what I did. I wrote until I controlled the memories. And all of that writing is what became this book.
Can you control the memories, Ron Kapp?
I think there are some memories that I may never fully control, because there are some things that I haven't just been able to get to yet, I have not written about. I know they're still out there. I know they're still in my head. But when I need to write about them, I will. But I would say that I have gotten control of the things. I've gotten control of the dead who came to talk to me at night. They no longer control me.
Ron Kapps, I want to thank you very much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Ron Kapps, his new book is called Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years. It's his account of the horrors that led to his diagnosis of PTSD and how he coped with it and how he became the founder of the Veterans Writing Project. For more on the book and to read works by veterans on the ODark 30 blog, you'll find links at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter at wordofmouth. From the bow and arrow to the unmanned drone, the weapons of war have evolved significantly. But one tool has persisted for centuries: music. The not-so-sweet sounds of psychological warfare, when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Since trumpets brought down the walls of Jericho, music has been part of the war narrative. And the playlist has gone far beyond the fife and drum corps of the American Revolution. From Scottish bagpipes to Metallica, Aaron Henkin takes us on a short tour through the history of music as a weapon.
The date is September 21st, 1745. You're a British soldier under the command of a confident General Cope in Edinburgh at Dunbar. You've been told to expect an impending clash with an unspecified number of Scottish Jacobite rebels. You can see nothing through the thick and disorienting fog. And suddenly, from nowhere and everywhere at once, your senses are assaulted by a blood-curdling wail, a relentless and unbearable sonic blast that envelops you and your fellow troops from seemingly all directions. Within 15 minutes, you and your fellow soldiers have lost your will to fight. You retreat as fast as your feet will carry you, and the battlefield is cleared. Within the year, the British government has classified the bagpipe as a weapon of war, unilaterally banned possession of the instrument, and declared that pipers can and should be tried in the same legal manner as those who carry conventional weapons. Fast forward 2.5 centuries. It's June 21st, 2004, in Iraq. American troops are conducting a large-scale morning raid in the western city of Ramadi. A line of approaching Humvees kicks up a wall of dust on the flat horizon. The U.S. battalion announces its arrival with the aid of roof-mounted public address speakers. In a military tip of the hat to the Francis Ford Coppola film Apocalypse Now, Iraqis on this morning are greeted with a high-volume assault of Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries. The raid is successful, and now it's a few months later. You're an Iraqi prisoner of war in an unspecified U.S. detention and interrogation facility. The BBC reports that you've been hooded and forced to stand facing a wall for 8 days straight, and that during the course of your interrogation, you've been subjected to high-volume 24-hour doses of the heavy metal band Metallica. U.S. Sergeant Mark Habsel explains, "These people haven't heard heavy metal before. They can't take it. If you play it for 24 hours, your brain and body functions start to slide. Your train of thought slows down, and your will is broken. That's when we come in and talk to them." Now rewind 11 years and transport yourself to Waco, Texas. You're a Branch Davidian, holed up in the Mount Carmel compound of apocalyptic cult leader David Koresh. A small army of federal agents has surrounded you with 100-watt amplifiers and public address speakers. Through the barricaded doors and boarded-up windows of the compound, you hear an ear-splitting but unidentifiable sound. After what seems like hours, the chanting of Tibetan monks bleeds into a Christmas carol. And then a Muslim prayer call. Then an Alice Cooper song. Then Nancy Sinatra. And all the while, this inscrutable playlist is being peppered with the looped sounds of sirens, babies crying, ticking clocks, dental drills, and telephone busy signals. The prolonged sonic barrage has a palpable effect. Nearby cattle herds are reported to stampede, and one of the Branch Davidians, a young mother, ceases lactating. You keep playing where you shouldn't be playing. Ironically, Nancy Sinatra's now infamous song includes the cryptic lyrics, "You keep thinking that you'll never get burned, but I just found me a brand new box of matches." The ultimate and controversial result of the Waco standoff, a fire that left 75 Branch Davidians dead, has since left the world scratching its head and wondering, among other things, about just how and whether we ought to attempt to harness the power of sound as a weapon.
Are you ready, Boots? Start walking. And that story came to us from Aaron Henkin. For lifelong Oasis fan Stephen Hyden, there is one sound that would have brought him to his knees faster than a speeding bullet not so long ago, the band Blur. He laments the demise of the music rivalry when word of mouth continues. I'm a professional cynic, but my heart's not in it. I'm paying the price of living life at the limit. God, I'm in the centuries, anxiety. Yes, it plays on
him. Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You have Red Sox versus Yankees in baseball, Facebook versus Google in the tech world, but when it comes to the best music rivalries, you have to go back a ways. Neil Young versus Lynyrd Skynyrd, Tupac against Biggie, Oasis or Blur?
You don't like not being fated as the greatest living songwriter in England. You can't stand that. And, of course, he wasn't at the time and I was. And he wanted a bit of the action. And you know what annoys me the most about it all? It's Blur and Oasis. Why did their name get put first? It's f***ing Oasis and Blur. For f***'s sake. Hats off to him for that.
Oasis's lead singer Noel Gallagher there talking about Blur lead singer Damon Albarn. The British tabloids took the bait, proclaiming Blur versus Oasis, the battle of Britpop, and fans were more than willing to play along. The music world has not had one of those petty, bitter, record-selling public dust-ups for a while. Our guest Stephen Hyden, staff writer at Grantland.com, asked why in his article, Whatever Happened to Music Rivalries? Stephen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you were quite willing to take sides in the Blur versus Oasis battle, which really mattered in Britain. So give us a little backstory about why you pick sides.
The way that rivalry began was that Oasis and Blur released singles on the same day in England. So it was really this sort of battle of capitalism in the British music scene, but that didn't occur here in the United States. So like if you were an American music fan like I was in the mid-90s, 16, 17 years old, and you really had to invent significance in your own mind, and I was more than willing to do that.
So what did being on the Oasis side of this rivalry entail for you?
They were coming out of grunge, you know, like where you had a lot of bands that were very ambivalent about being rock stars. You had this band Oasis that where the first song on their first record is called Rock and Roll Star, you know, and it's about wanting to be famous and wanting to be rich. I'm a rock and roll star. It was a very working class perspective, you know, because they were coming from nothing. And I think that's what they represented to me, that they were this sort of like, you know, people's band. And if you liked Oasis for that reason, it was really easy to look at Blur as sort of the antithesis of that. You know, like if this were like Animal House, Oasis was like John Belushi, and like Blur were like, you know, like the snooty like fraternity, you know. So you're gonna cheer for the slobs, not the snobs, or at least that's where I came at it from.
And it was pretty hard to shake for you, apparently. Why do you think it stayed with you so long after spiky gelled male hair and the Caesar haircut went out of style?
You know, it's funny. I think this is true for a lot of people, where those opinions about music that you form when you're in high school, they tend to stick with you in ways that you maybe don't even realize when you get older. I mean, I think people tend to still be kind of tribal in a way about like the kinds of music that they like or the bands that they liked. And yeah, you know, what I wrote about in that column was the fact that like for the last 20 years, like I never listened to an entire Blur record. I never listened to any of Damon Albarn's other bands. I just held on to this hate of this guy, like, and it was, and I acknowledge that it's stupid, you know, and I was the wrong one, but like I don't know. It was like I had such a loyalty to Oasis that I could not bring myself to even listen to anything associated with Blur.
You really showed him.
Exactly.
Well, we're past that now. Today, however, you say that music rivalries like between Blur and Oasis just don't exist anymore. Why not, do you think?
It's not so much that, I mean, because obviously there are still instances where pop stars are arguing with each other and there's beefs and all that. But the difference now is that, you know, in the age of social media, it's so much easier to start a fight with somebody and then to also end a fight mm-hmm. with somebody. I mean, all you have to do is send out, you know, 140 characters, you know, mildly disparaging someone, and the internet will take that and run with it. I think that you need a certain amount of space to let, like, the dislike be truly marinated, you know, to truly marinate in that dislike
uh-huh.
between two people, you know. And I don't know if we have that anymore. I think things just get blown out of proportion so quickly, you know, the fuel kind of burns really fast and then it's gone.
So take us through some of the great pre-internet age musical death matches.
Well, I think probably the greatest one ever is Beatles versus Stones. In a way, I feel like that's like the blueprint for every other feud that's happened since, because in that case, you had a really obvious kind of black and white option. You had like the good guys and you had like the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And some people liked the bad guys because they thought the good guys were too goody-goody, you know, and that kind of dichotomy exists in a lot of other rivalries. You mentioned Biggie and Tupac
mm-hmm.
being a huge one. And in that case, you had East Coast hip hop versus West Coast hip hop, you know, the originators of rap and like the upstarts.
Who shot ya? Separate the weak from the ops. Leap hard to creep them Brooklyn streets. Your heartbeat sound like Sasquatch feet. Thundering, shaking the concrete. Saw me in the drop, 3 1/4. Slaughter, electrical tape around the daughter. Old school, new school, need to learn though. I burn, baby, burn like disco inferno. Burn slow.
You mentioned Neil Young and Lynyrd Skynyrd mm-hmm. before, and I think that's a great rivalry because, I mean, you still see evidence of that today, like the song Sweet Home Alabama name checks Neil Young, because Neil Young wrote a song called Alabama, which kind
not
of,
entirely complimentary.
Alabama, you got the weight on your shoulders that's breaking your back.
That leads to the question, were these kind of things trumped up to sell more records?
Yeah, I mean, I think to some degree that's certainly the case. But what makes these rivalries important is what they signify to fans. I think like one really significant rivalry of this century is Toby Keith and the Dixie Chicks. After 9/11, Toby Keith wrote a song called The Angry American.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was going to put his boot up the butt of Osama bin Laden.
Because we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list.
Natalie Maines from the Dixie Chicks made fun of the song and disparaged Toby Keith. But, I mean, I think that is a clear instance of, like, a musical rivalry having larger cultural significance, that, in a way, you could look at just that rivalry and use it as a case study in like how the country was divided mm-hmm. after 9/11, mm-hmm. you know, like how we were united initially and then, you know, what the political divisions were among people with different points of view.
Well, Stephen, do you miss the rivalry? I mean, good for fans, good for the industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good for the industry. Obviously, there's nothing like a fight to get people interested in things. But again, you know, I like to think of pop music as a way that like culture works out their feelings about the world and how we determine what's important. And I think that these rivalries are like the battlegrounds that we use to do that. That
really not sports, not...
Well, sports too. I mean, I'm not saying just pop music, but I think that pop music at its best and at its most significant does do that for the culture. And I think if you lose that, then pop music to me seems a little less vital.
Well, Stephen Hayden, thank you for your time. I guess we can't all just get along.
And thank goodness we can't.
Stephen Hyden, staff writer at Grantland.com. He wrote the article, Whatever Happened to Music Rivalries? You'll find a link to the article on wordofmouthradio.org, and we'd love to know which are your favorite music rivalries. Let us know. We're at wordofmouthradio.org and on facebook.com/wordofmouthradio.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now you should have somehow realized what you gotta do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now.
Whether based in reality or not, the Beatles versus Rolling Stones rivalry once deeply divided rock and roll fans. Up next, we'll speak with a music writer firmly embedded in Camp Stones, an insider seat at the French villa where Exile on Main Street was made, when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When the Rolling Stones embarked on a farewell tour of Britain in March of 1971, there were no laminates, no backstage passes, and no sound checks. Just a rock and roll band in a bus playing new songs like Brown Sugar and Wild Horses, and a longtime creative partnership teetering on the brink. All that and a young journalist named Robert Greenfield. He was then at Rolling Stone magazine's London Bureau and was the only reporter to accompany the Stones on that tour before their self-imposed tax refuge on France's Mediterranean coast. Greenfield then joined them at Nelcote, Keith Richards' rented villa during the making of Exile on Main Street, one of the band's most critically acclaimed album. Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye? The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile is Greenfield's third book on the Stones. And Robert Greenfield, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, set us the general sky for us. The original band member, Brian Jones, then dead, the infamous Redlands bust behind them, the killing of a fan at Altamont. How was the band and its record company responding to all of the challenges?
Well, they had a new record company. You know, they had formed their own label, one of the first bands to do so, Rolling Stones Records. They had left Decca after many years of a bad contract. They had rid themselves of Alan Klein, who was, had also been managing the Beatles. They were broke. They owed the Inland Revenue in England a fantastic amount of money. They were in like the 95% tax bracket. Other than that, everything was really good. what nobody knew, because no one had heard it, was that they had finished recording Sticky Fingers. And Sticky Fingers becomes the beginning of the next chapter of the Rolling Stones' career. Nobody at that point knows that this is going to be their biggest album ever, that it is going to take off worldwide in a way that nothing they've ever done before has. It's going to be their most commercial album, their biggest success.
Childhood living is easy.
They're playing 2,000-seat venues, decrepit city halls that haven't been painted since like 1897, you know. And everything smells as things could only smell in England back then. They're doing two shows a night. And I am this kid who's never been on the road with anybody before. And every night I'm standing on stage, and the Stones would be doing Bitch, Brown Sugar, Wild Horses. No one had ever heard these songs. The album wasn't out. But they had to go on the road because they had to leave England by a certain date. And the tour itself was motivated really by a desire to go around their homeland for the last time. And on every level, symbolically and every other level, this really was the end of the first chapter of their professional career.
It was one of the things that prompted Keith Richards to try and kick his heroin addiction before the tour. Tell us a little bit about the impact of his addiction on the band.
Well, what was really fascinating about the Stones in general, and Mick and Keith in particular, is that by 1971, they had already been famous for 5 years. And as I say in the book, they, both Mick and Keith, were practiced at the art of deception. And so there was no knowing during the 10 days of the tour that Keith Richards, along with his very close friend Graham Parsons, late of the Byrds, and the Flying Burrito Brothers, had undergone this horrific apomorphine cure recommended to them by William Burroughs, the author, in which they basically just lay in bed and were sick for, you know, it's really disgusting. I don't need to get into the details. They went through hell, they cleaned up, and they immediately started using again. And both of them, along with Keith's companion, Anita Pallenberg, the actress, were using heroin on this tour. But I didn't know that. I don't know who else on the tour would have known that. Things went on behind closed doors. Mick was then with Bianca, who became his first wife. No one knew that she was pregnant. It's really, if I may say, rock and roll days of our lives. A soap opera of major proportions, where Mick and Keith are already traveling separately, and all the tension that's going to build and build in the south of France, the split that is coming between these two really creative geniuses musically. It's all there between the buttons, as we say.
We're talking with Robert Greenfield. He's a journalist, a screenwriter, and author of several books. Most recently, Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye? It's a pretty raucous insider account of his unprecedented access to the Rolling Stones at a really critical time in the band's career, the last tour before their self-imposed tax exile. A lot more is going on, and that's the real story here, Robert, about the pivotal change in the Rolling Stones' creative songwriting engine. Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. Now, you mentioned Richards was with the actress and model Anita Pallenberg, mother of his son. Mick, ready to marry or married to the exquisite Bianca Perez Morera de Macias. Tell us a little
Marina.
Bit.
She had many names. She had many, many last names.
Let me try again. The exquisite Bianca Perez Morena de Macias.
That's it.
Tell us a little bit about her and her influence on Mick.
Oh, dear. Bianca was something, you know. She was completely self-created. She was extraordinarily beautiful. She was incredibly mysterious. She had an amazing accent. She dressed like Daisy Callahan. She smoked cigarettes out of long yellow ivory holders. She was one of the most exotic human beings I've ever encountered. And people didn't know what to make of her. She was not rock and roll. Anita was rock and roll. And everybody on the tour was concerned because, you know, whither Mick goest is whither goest the Stones. No one knew what it was that she wanted. Well, she wanted to marry him. And what I would think still ranks as the greatest rock and roll wedding of all time in Saint-Tropez that May, if only in terms of the guest list. As someone said, if that private plane had crashed on the way from London, the rock business would have been set back 100 years. Paul McCartney, Eric Clapton, on and on and on. Everybody attended that wedding.
You point to the kind of class-climbing, aspirational nature of Mick Jagger. Yeah. In fact, you call him a shapeshifter in the book at one point. Now, this is all kind of brought into focus at Mick's wedding to Bianca in March of 1971. You talked about the guest list, but what happened there that kind of signified the split between the soon-to-be-called Glimmer Twins, I guess?
Well, at the wedding, Keith does an enormous amount of a white powder substance that you put in your nose, which is not talcum. He gets to the civil ceremony late. They don't want to let him in because he looks like he's dressed like somebody who's hitchhiking through Europe. He starts choking. It could be the chief of police in Saint-Tropez. This gets settled. They admit him to the church, and he sits down on the bride's side after the wedding. There's a huge party at the Hotel Biblos, very exclusive in Saint-Tropez. And Keith authorizes someone to get people up on stage for what would have been probably the greatest rock and roll jam in the history of the universe. So, you know, here comes Clapton, here come all the stars. And so when the guy who's got everybody ready to play goes up to find Keith, he's passed out. And he, in fact, never gets on stage, never plays. And from that point on, then Mick goes on his honeymoon. I mean, the making of the album is detailed in a book I wrote about Exile on Main Street, but it couldn't have been more brutal, more laborious, more time-consuming. And then basically there are so many drugs going through that house, Villa Nelcutt, that the Stones are forced to flee for their lives. They're all about to be arrested and thrown into jail in the south of France.
Mm. Well, it's not just the two of them. It's the tensions between Bianca and Anita that are kind of spilling over, some of which you witnessed many times, but in particular before a gig in Liverpool. Now, what can you tell us about them that is safe for radio?
The rumor that was around was that on the previous tour, Bianca lent Anita some clothes. And if you'd seen Anita in action back then, God knows what she would have done in the course of an evening. And it seems like she returned them with so many substances that Bianca threw out the clothing. And I guess if between two rock and roll divas, I guess it's kind of a Solange Beyonce situation.
Oh, he went there.
No kicking, but you know, it was a long time ago, you know.
But so you were assigned to interview Keith during this debauched summer following this tour. I'm remembering from Keith's biography that they got into a boat and had a great time in Italy.
Name of the boat was the Mandrax.
That
kind of says it all. Go ahead.
But something worked, right? The descent worked. Even if they were unraveling, they made a great record.
Well, I was there in what I call the garden period. The mobile studio was there. They actually hadn't started recording in the basement. Keith had not yet started using heroin again. And this is very F. Scott Fitzgerald. But every day was a party. And it was just like, okay, what are we going to do today? We're going to go out on the boat. We're going to go water skiing. We're going to go drive around the south of France in my red Jaguar. He was having a great time. The point being that out of this cauldron, yes, out of this kind of hellish, summer that they had, they did come up with Exile. A lot of the music on Exile was not recorded during that period. People who love the Stones know this. They're versions of stuff that had been done at Olympia some years earlier. But that is Keith's album. That's Keith wanting to get back to rock and roll, wanting to play hard riffs, wanting to play the blues. As I always say, when Exile came out, double album, no one really knew what to make of it. People liked it. Some didn't like it. Stones were ahead of the culture at that point. And when they went out on the road in 72, it wasn't like they were playing the songs from that album. The big stuff was still Honky Tonk Women and Satisfaction. And basically the great stuff they had done on the English tour the spring before.
Robert, it makes for a great read, this Days of Our Life portion of the book. But isn't it kind of simplistic to make Bianca the Yoko Ono of the band, or, you know, Anita the Linda McCartney, when it was actually Richard's addiction that he was truly wedded to? And that is why Mick later plotted to replace him, as you tell us in the book.
You know, this is completely true. It's not about the women who broke this band up. You know, all due respect to women everywhere. There are no women who can break this band up. You know, this speaks to the way Mick and Keith feel about their music. I mean, if Mick and Keith are not speaking to each other for huge periods of time, and yet they can lean into the same microphone and sing harmony on stage, and you think they're two brothers, that says a lot. So it's absolutely true that Bianca did not break up this band. Anita did not break up this band. You know, Keith went missing for so long that Mick had to take over all of the business and financial dealings. And really, and I think even Keith knows this at this point, were it not for Mick Jagger, the Rolling Stones would no longer exist. He's the one who on a daily basis has never stopped taking care of business. And you have to have somebody do that or else there is no business.
Robert Greenfield, former associate editor of the London Bureau of Rolling Stone magazine. He's author of several books on rock and roll. Most recently, Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile. You can find much more on him and his work at wordofmouthradio.org. Robert Greenfield, what a pleasure speaking with you.
Virginia, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. If you like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. We find the most fascinating stories get passed around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.